This is the second in a new series titled The Outer Darkness, brought to you by Mission 119 Ministries. My name is Hudson Smelly. In the first session, I introduced what is at issue, that is the three outer darkness passages in the Gospel of Matthew. Those are Matthew 8, 5 to 12, Matthew 22, 1 to 14, and Matthew 25, 14 to 30. In the first session, I covered Matthew 8, 5 to 12, and a considerable amount of background that's important. I'm not going to repeat all that background, but I will try to do some bit of summary of it, as it will help us put our hands around this parable of the wedding banquet found in Matthew 22, verses 1 to 14. Now, the question before us is, in these outer darkness passages that only appear in Matthew's gospel, are those placed in outer darkness believers who are being temporarily excluded from the kingdom and will be included later? Or are they non-believers who will be permanently excluded from the kingdom and therefore ultimately at the judgment sent to the lake of fire? My view is the latter. That's the more common view, and I think it's the correct one. And as I'll try to demonstrate, as I've mentioned before, this is not a hill to die on issue. I think it's interesting. I think it has some importance, but it is one that people can reasonably differ about. When I looked at Matthew 8, 5 to 12, I tried to show some background I think is important. The near-term context for Matthew 8, 5 to 12 is the Sermon on the Mount. It's on the heels of the Sermon on the Mount that Jesus, having set the standard of perfection that God requires, see Matthew 5, having stated that in order to ever be in the kingdom, you have to have righteousness that exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, and having established in Matthew 7 that it's not doing that will determine whether you're in the kingdom, for there will be people who will say, Lord, Lord, didn't we do this and we did that? And he will say, I never knew you. Depart from me. So the issue is knowing him, having a relationship, and it is a matter of faith. The standard is perfection, as the last verse in Matthew 5 indicates. And so anyone who thinks they can work their way into the kingdom is mistaken. The book is very much about faith. It is a gospel written to a Jewish audience. And we know that on the whole, not without exception, but characteristically, the Jewish people during Jesus' earthly ministry rejected him as the Christ, and so did the leadership. And I tried to show that, you know, as you enter Matthew 8, the first thing he does is heal a leper that sends a message to the leadership, because he sends this healed man to the priest to be certified clean. And so they're going to realize he's done this messianic miracle, one only a Messiah could do, that would tend to establish his messiahship, and they have to make a decision. But you quickly see the resistance that Jesus faces in Matthew's gospel. In chapter 9, he cast out a demon, and he's accused of doing that by the power of Beelzebub. An incident like that is repeated in Matthew 12. Matthew 11 and 12 both make statements about how if Jesus' miracles had been done before Gentiles, those Gentiles would have repented and never been judged. He includes Sodom and Gomorrah. He includes the Ninevites as a group of people who did repent, which is to the shame of the Jewish people, who hearing much more revelation, having heard the Son of God and witnessed his miracles, did not turn to God. And this seems to persist throughout the book. That is, that characteristically, he is rejected. So much so that Matthew 12 and 13 become a turning point where Jesus begins preaching in parables about the kingdom. He does it intentionally to hide the truth. He only wants to reveal further truth to those who are already believers. He will pronounce judgment in no uncertain terms in several chapters. It'll culminate, especially in Matthew 23, immediately before the Olivet Discourse. And of course, the Olivet Discourse itself, Matthew 24 and 25, will speak about this matter of judgment. And so, in a book that's all about judgment and trying to get our hands around these outer darkness passages, I suggested a few other contextual matters that I think are helpful to place it in the larger picture of the Gospel of Matthew. One of those is that there are so many passages about the kingdom. It seems that it's always that people are in the kingdom or they're not, never that there's a third option where people are temporarily excluded only to be included later. This culminates in Matthew 25, immediately after the parable of the talents. Jesus is finished with parables and he speaks of the final judgment when he returns. And we sometimes call this the sheep and the goat judgment, because The nations are brought before him, and those who are believers are placed on one side, on his right-hand side, and they enter the kingdom. The other ones are on his left-hand side, they're the goats, they don't enter the kingdom. There's no allowance for probationary sheep who won't enter the kingdom now but will later, suggesting that the view of outer darkness, that there is a third group who will be judged and will get in the kingdom, but only after a probationary period where they're excluded. There seems to be no allowance for it anywhere explicitly, including, critically, the detailed judgment described in Matthew 25. In addition, I suggested that the outer darkness passages all mention gnashing of teeth, wailing or weeping and gnashing of teeth. Some other verses mention that as well, and in the first session I read through all of those, and the point was really a simple one. You have passages that everyone agrees involve judgment where people are dispatched to the lake of fire, such as the parable of the wheat and tares in Matthew 13, where the tares are put into the burning furnace, and their reaction of those people is weeping and gnashing of teeth. It seems that weeping and gnashing of teeth is always associated with the final eschatological judgment of the damned. I think the same is true in the outer darkness passages. That is, if you're reading outer darkness passages and other passages where people are unquestionably sent to hell and judgment, and the result is weeping and gnashing of teeth, then we may infer that the outer darkness is the same. It is an expression, a metaphor type expression perhaps, of the very same place, the abode of those who will spend eternity separated from God, with the same result as those thrown into the blazing furnace of Matthew 13, that is, weeping and gnashing of teeth. So my conclusion about Matthew 8 is that the centurion there is presented as a Gentile who's described as having great faith because he had requested that Jesus would heal his servant. When Jesus was ready to come to his home, he said, "There'll be no need of that. I'm a man under authority. I have troops under my authority. They do what I say. I understand what it is to be under authority. And I understand that you as the Christ have authority," is basically his great faith. And he knows that Jesus doesn't need to go to his home. Indeed, he says, I'm not really worthy to have you in my home. If you would just command that my servant be healed, then it would be done. And so Jesus says, well, that's great faith. The contrast is between finding great faith where a Jewish audience would be surprised to find faith at all, with finding no faith where there ought to be great faith. Contrasting the great faith of the Gentile centurion, the Roman centurion, who most of the Jews despised, with the faithlessness, it would seem, of so many of the Jewish people during Jesus' earthly ministry. And again, as I said, that interpretation fits what seems to happen in virtually every chapter of Matthew, where there's resistance to Jesus and complete faithlessness. The other view of the outer darkness, that it is temporary exclusion from the kingdom, at least as regarding the Matthew 8 passage, Matthew 8, 5 to 12, it's built largely on two things. One is an argument that what's being contrasted is great faith by the centurion to mediocre faith by Jewish people, and for this mediocre faith, they are temporarily excluded. I've suggested that just contextually, that's not what makes sense. What you're seeing throughout Matthew is a comparison between Gentiles who had faith and Jewish folks who don't. The men of Nineveh, the men Jesus deals with in the first century. Sodom and Gomorrah, had they seen Jesus' miracles, they would have repented. The Jewish people won't accept him as Messiah. That's always the comparison. Never great faith to mediocre faith. They would also say that the sons of the kingdom, that reference in Matthew 8, verse 13, where Jesus says, "But the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." That expression is only used one other time in the Bible. It's in Matthew 13 in the Jesus' explanation of the parable of the wheat and tares. And they argue that in that parable, the sons of the kingdom was unquestionably used to refer to believers, and therefore it must be believers here in Matthew 8. I do agree that that expression is used of believers in Matthew 13. That does not mean that that expression must be have the same meaning in Matthew 8. It's not a rabbinic expression. It's not a term of art. It is a general description. The Jewish people in the first century unquestionably believed that they were going to be in the kingdom merely because they're Jewish. That comes out in a number of places, such as John chapter 8. It is well documented that this was a common Pharisaic understanding. So one of the things Jesus does is reveal the shocking truth to them that not all Jewish people will be in the kingdom. And in particular, you have this great contrast in the outer darkness passage in Matthew 8. And so my suggestion is that sons of the kingdom there, it was used because they would understand it's talking about them. They're the ones who, they've been invited. They expect to be there. And then Jesus makes a shocking statement that some of them won't. He uses the phrase that is how they would think of themselves, perhaps, sons of the kingdom, and then says, but you're not going to be there. Now, he, of course, doesn't mean all of them. His own disciples are Jewish, Peter, others in his group. His 12 apostles, we know there's a bad egg in there, but the other 11 are Jewish men, and they've unquestionably have faith in him, and they will be in the kingdom. But we're talking about characteristically how that generation received Jesus, and characteristically, it was faithless. So the weeping and gnashing of teeth is the same response that you see in the passages that talk about the blazing furnace, where everyone agrees it's in fact hell. And that seems to be the point here. That is that in the kingdom, there will be a Gentiles present, and there will also be Jewish people absent. Not all Gentiles will be there. Not all Jewish people will be absent, but there will be both. And that's maybe a scandalous statement in the first century. Well, I want to move to the second outer darkness passage. And as I suggested in the first lesson, the only way to get your hands around this issue is to study all three passages in detail. My first lesson was not intended to be comprehensive and perhaps raises as many questions as it might answer. The Matthew 8 passage is rather short. There's not a lot of immediate detail to give us great certainty about the interpretation, although I tried to build out the greater context of Matthew 5 through 8, and then the book as a whole, and show how it fits the flow of the argument. When you get into these other passages, the one in Matthew 22, the one in Matthew 25, you get a lot more detail, and I think it, to the extent there might be any doubt after reading Matthew 8, those doubts get removed when you get to Matthew 22, and if there's yet a doubt still in Matthew 25, he puts a cork on it. So it's important to go through this passage, and we'll have at least one more lesson to go through the third outer darkness passage, and I hope you'll catch those, and then you can put all the data together and I think arrive at the right understanding. Now, Matthew 22 has a wonderful parable. It's interesting that this passage is used both for this concept of outer darkness that some take to mean temporary exclusion from the kingdom. It's also a favorite of Calvinists. Those who are familiar with my teaching know that I am no Calvinist. I would take what some would call a free grace position, and you'll see that throughout all the series that are posted on sermon audio and posted on YouTube. And you'll see that here, but I won't belabor that point, but because we're in the passage, we'll deal with it. But I want to deal with this outer darkness. The immediate context, without getting and repeating all the big picture that I did in the first lesson, the immediate context of the parable that occurs in Matthew 22, verses 1 to 14, is a parable at the end of Matthew 21. I'm not going to try to exegete the whole thing, but I want to read through a little bit of it, because Jesus is basically teaching the same thing, very similar, not identical, but basically the same sort of lesson in our key passage today as he is in the parable immediately before it, and he's teaching it to the same people. So Matthew 21, starting in verse 33, Jesus says, listen to another parable. Now, I'll say this, and this will become important to understanding why there's a lot of, I think, misunderstanding about the wedding banquet. Parables are not history. They are stories in some sense that are designed to help reveal truth and conceal it. You get that from Matthew 13. Jesus teaches the parable of the sower, and his disciples are like, why did you start teaching in parables? What's the deal? Jesus says, well, I'm going to hide the truth from certain people, those who have not put their faith in him as the Christ, and reveal truths about the kingdom to others. And most of the parables in Matthew are then focused on the kingdom. The parable of the sower is not. It's about comprehension and who will understand parables and who will not. It gives you some guidance into understanding the rest of the parables in Matthew 13. But in the balance of Matthew 13 and thereafter, most of the parables have to do in one way or another with the kingdom. And so does this one. But parables teach by analogy. And so when we read a parable, it's not that every little element of the parable has some symbolic meaning. It's also to be kept in mind that, again, it's not history, as I said. In other words, if something happens in a parable, it doesn't mean that it did happen or that it could happen. It's a story designed to teach by example, by illustration, by analogy, but it can have a certain surreal nature to it. It could be something that might not really be all that realistic, and yet it teaches the main point. No one reads the parable of the Good Samaritan and believes that Jesus is actually teaching a story about something that actually happened. Maybe it could, but it provides a good analogy to teach and answer a very basic question. Lord, who is my neighbor? Who shall I love? Jesus says, whoever's in need, right? So looking at Matthew 21:33, listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard and put a fence around it. He dug a wine press in it and built a watchtower. He leased it to tenant farmers and went away. And when the time came to harvest the fruit, he sent his servants to the farmers to collect his fruit. Now, in the old days, you might rent out land. Someone else would grow a crop, and their payment that they had to pay for that use of the land was a part of the crop. And that's what's happening here. So he sends some farmers to collect the fruit. The farmers... he sent servants to the farmers to collect the fruit. The farmers took his servants, beat one, killed another, and stoned a third. Again, he sent other servants, more than the first group, and they did the same to them. Finally, he sent his son. Now, it doesn't take rocket science to figure out that what is being talked about is really the king would seem to be a picture, by analogy, of God the Father. God the Father sent prophets to the Jewish nation. And generally speaking, those prophets were ill-treated. Generally speaking, their messages were not well-received. That's the reason the prophets aren't even preached in churches today, because the churches don't want to hear it either. They respond much the way as Israel did. And when you read the Old Testament prophets, those messages are often very harsh. And so you can understand when the servants go to the farmers to collect their fruit, they're mistreated or even killed. How many of the prophets were killed? I mean, Isaiah martyred, so many of the others. Were killed, and that's the picture. And then he sends his son. You know, the last prophet that God the Father would send would be John the Baptizer. What happened to him? They killed him. And so then his son is sent, and they would kill him too. So as we read on, it says, finally he sent his son. See, for centuries there were prophets, writing prophets, some prophets that didn't write. That is, we don't have their books in our Bible, people like Elijah. But ultimately it culminated in sending his son. Finally, he sent his son to them. They will respect my son, he said. Verse 38, but when the tenant farmers saw the son, they said to each other, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him and take his inheritance. So they seized him, threw him out of the vineyard, and killed him. Therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those farmers? He will completely destroy those terrible men. They told him, and lease his vineyard to other farmers who will give him his fruit at the harvest. And then Jesus gives some teaching based on this parable. He said, have you never read in the scripture, meaning the Old Testament? So he has people in the audience he anticipates would know the Old Testament and be familiar with this passage. Have you never read, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This is what the Lord has done, and it is wonderful in our eyes. Therefore, I tell you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people producing its fruit. Whoever falls on this stone will be broken to pieces, but on whomever it falls, it will shatter them. They are stumbling on the stone that is Jesus Christ. He is not what they expected. He's what they should have expected. The Old Testament prophets are very clear about a lot of things about Christ. but they had developed a lot of ideas, a lot of preconceptions, and so they stumble at Christ. And for that reason, the kingdom will be taken away. Now, that's a temporary taking away. He says it'll be provided to a people producing its fruit, and I'll suggest to you, this is not saying it's being given to the Gentiles so much as it's being saying that there'll be a future time, and it'll be given to that people, and that people will be a combination of Jews and Gentiles in faith. But however that may be, look at who the audience is, and this is so critical to getting into the parable in Matthew 22. It says in verse 45 of Matthew 21, when the chief priests and Pharisees heard his parables, that's our audience. These are the very people who have resisted him throughout. You see it in Matthew 9. You just see it through and through. Even in the Matthew 5 in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus makes the statement that if your righteousness doesn't exceed the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom. That suggests that he's already butted heads with these guys. I don't think it's a statement he would have made had they characteristically accepted his messiahship. It's because of their rejection. Outwardly, they do have some meticulous keeping of the law. Inwardly, no. And they've not responded to him in faith. So understand, that's the audience for the wedding banquet parable, the outer darkness that follows. And although they were looking for a way to arrest him, they feared the crowds because the people regarded him as a prophet. Now, I suggested in Matthew 8 that the way that passage gets taken is a comparison between the Roman centurion, who had great faith, and some other believers who have mediocre faith. And specifically, it's Jewish believers. So if this outer darkness passages, if they really are teaching that there are some people temporarily prohibited from the kingdom, it would seem to be limited to Jewish people and not include anyone else. These parables all happen before the cross. There's no reference to Gentiles being excluded from the kingdom temporarily. It's just Jewish people who have responded to Jesus' earthly ministry with rejection. That's who's in view in every one of the passages, all three of them. And those who would say, well, he's comparing great faith to mediocre faith, I think that's conjectural. But you can't bear that out in Matthew 22 because the audience are these Pharisees. And it says in Matthew 21:45, when they heard him, they knew he was talking about them. Although they were looking for a way to arrest him, they feared the crowds. These aren't people with mediocre faith. These are people of no faith at all. And after Jesus tells the parable of the wedding banquet, when you get to verse 15 of Matthew 22, their response to his wedding banquet parable is the following. Then the Pharisees went and plotted how to trap him by what he said. So they're not people of mediocre faith. They're faithlessness. They are like those that Jesus has spoken about repeatedly. And it will culminate in the very next chapter in 23 with a very explicit statement of judgment by Jesus. So let's, with all this background, let's read through this parable. It's not a difficult parable, and it's very similar in meaning to the parable we just read through about the vineyard. So once more, Jesus spoke to them in parables. The them is the scribes and Pharisees of the prior couple of verses. And he says, the kingdom of heaven is like. And he's going to teach a parable. It's like this. He's using this analogy. It's like a king who gave a wedding banquet for his son. Now, remember in the prior parable, who do they reject? Their condemnation comes not because they rejected the servants that came to collect the fruit that was due, essentially the rent. The judgment comes on them because they rejected and killed the son. Same thing will happen here. That is, there's a focus on the king, but you'll see that he's prepared a marriage banquet for his son. So rejecting the invitation to come to the marriage banquet for the son is to reject the son. So with that in mind, let's read on. There's a king who gave a wedding banquet for his son. Verse 3, he sent his servants to summon those invited to the banquet. These people were already invited. What's happened is the day of the wedding has come. The banquet is ready. The food is ready. The drinks are ready to serve. Everybody has their places, and no one has shown up. So he sends the servants to summon those invited to the banquet. Now, that's a long history of prophets, perhaps, but certainly culminating in John the Baptist, who clearly fits the bill of summoning the Jewish people. That's his audience. They're the ones invited to the banquet. But they didn't want to come. Again, he sent other servants, and he said, "Tell those who were invited, see, I've prepared my dinner. My oxen and fattened calf have been slaughtered, and everything's ready. Come to the wedding banquet." This isn't about getting people to come to a wedding a month from now. This is that they have been invited to a wedding today. And now it's today, and now the food's ready to be served, and the drinks are ready to be served, and they aren't there because they don't want to come. That's the Jewish response. Not every last individual, and I keep reiterating that, but I don't want to be misunderstood. Lots of Jewish people came to Jesus in faith. You see, you know, he has disciples with him. We find them, you know, after the resurrection. They're gathered together in Acts 1. I mean, lots of people believed. Nicodemus probably believed. Lazarus, you know, lots of people, but most rejected. That's the fact. Most rejected, and especially among the leaders. And so he's dealing, again, you can't look at it in such a rigid, literal way that if no one who's invited comes, that would mean that all Jewish people reject him. That simply isn't true, and anyone who reads Matthew or the other Gospels know that's not true. It's a parable, it's an analogy, and it's designed to teach us by analogy, and we need to be, caution. We have a caution about being so rigid and trying to make the parable as if it's describing history when it's not intended to be pushed that far. Well, he sends them and says, everything's ready, come to the wedding banquet, like now, like pick up your stuff and come. Verse 5 says, but they paid no attention. No attention to who? Those servants that he sent. And they went away, one to his own farm, another to his business, while the rest seized his servants, mistreated them, and killed them. Now that's pretty extreme. It's difficult to imagine that you would ever have a case where, you know, you didn't want to go to a wedding, so you turned down the invitation, but you also killed the messenger. You see how it takes on a certain absurdity. And a parable can do that because it's teaching by analogy. So, as I said earlier, it's almost surreal what will happen in some of these parables. But again, teaching by analogy, who do they kill? The servants. Who are the servants? They're the prophets, just like the parable of the vineyard at the end of Matthew 21. The king was enraged, as he should be, and he sent out his troops, killed those murderers, and burned down their city. Now, we could argue that maybe that was fulfilled in 70 AD when God allowed Titus, the Roman general, to come through with Roman troops and sack Jerusalem. It may be. It doesn't matter. The point is, within the story, it makes perfect sense. If a king had a wedding feast and he sent servants to get people to get over to the wedding feast because it's time to start, and they kill the servants, it would not be a surprise to us that king in the ancient world would send his troops and take his revenge. So it's a natural thing. Now, verse 8, then he told his servants, the banquet's ready, but those who were invited were not worthy. Why were they not worthy? Well, because they didn't come, because they said, we've got better things to do. And that is characterizing the Jewish response during Jesus' earthly ministry. Jesus comes, he says the kingdom of heaven is at hand. It seems from other passages, particularly Revelation 19, that immediately before the kingdom begins, there will be this wedding supper of the Lamb, is how it's sometimes called. And so the idea, there's a legitimate offer, the kingdom made, by Christ personally. He says the kingdom's at hand. It's ready to start. It's time. And they said no. And that fits here. So he tells his servants, verse 8, the banquet's ready, and those who invited were not worthy. Go then to where the roads exit the city and invite everyone you find at the banquet. Now what he's telling them to do is to go to the exits of the city, because at least a big city like Jerusalem would have a lot of trade, so you'd find Gentiles there. And his point is, forget the people who got the invitations on stationery. You know, the food is on the table. It needs to be eaten. There needs to be somebody at my son's wedding. And since those who were invited said no, go get those who weren't invited, which would generally be the Gentiles, and bring them. And so it says they gathered. Those servants went out on the roads and gathered everyone they found, both evil and good. The wedding banquet was filled with guests. Now, I'll say here, and it seems that the guests are brought immediately from wherever they're found to the banquet. That is, they didn't go give an invitation where the guest, you know, go and come back a few weeks later to the wedding. The idea is urgency because the wedding banquet is ready to start. And so just go grab those people and bring them. That's important, I think, to what happens next. When the king came in to see the guest, he's there to greet him, of course. He saw a man there who was not dressed for a wedding. If you're going to go to a royal wedding, you should show up dressed appropriately. That's easy for the people who were invited, who had months to think about it. But how did the people who were just brought off the highways and byways, the ones that are described as being good and bad, just everybody, how is it they would have garments? And here's this one guy that doesn't. Now, my suggestion is the king has provided the garments in some way. There are those who would say no. They would argue there's nothing in the context that says it. They are right that the context doesn't explicitly say it. But the context is people being gathered who were never invited, who had no time to think about it. And in the ancient world, people, just good and bad, this is a wide spectrum of society, wouldn't even necessarily own wedding garments, much less have the wherewithal to go get dressed and go to the wedding. They are being taken directly from where they're invited, I think, out just in the roads and the byways, where Gentiles would be found, and they're being taken immediately to the banquet. So the question of where would they get the royal garments, I think, has to be provided by the king. I think it's implied, and I think it's the key to the parable, but those who take the outer darkness as temporary exclusion will argue that that's not the case. But we'll move on. That seems to be clearly what has to happen, given where these guests were found. Now, the king sees a guest there who's not dressed for a wedding, and he says to him, "Friend, how did you get in here without wedding clothes?" The man was speechless. Then the king told the attendants, "Tie him up hand and foot and throw him out into the outer darkness, and there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." I have some concerns about the idea of the outer darkness being temporary exclusion. This guy isn't politely asked to leave. He's tied hand and foot, bound as a prisoner, and thrown out, forcibly removed, because he doesn't have the garment. Now, those who take the outer darkness to be temporary exclusion will argue that this man is merely being removed from the banquet. He'll be in the kingdom at some later point. Either after the banquet or after the millennium, he'll get back in, and he's just been removed because he didn't have a wedding garment. The wedding garment being essentially a fruitfulness, righteous deeds that he could have done as a believer but didn't. So he's been excluded. There's no indication, I should say, of that, I think, in this passage. But that is the approach taken to it. Their concern is that if he's not a believer at all and being dispatched to hell, how did he get to the banquet to begin with? After all, one could never show up to the banquet, could he, if he wasn't a believer to begin with? I think that's fallacious, and it's why I made the comments earlier about this matter of parables. Parables are not recording history. This parable is unquestionably surreal in how it's approached. It has absurdities in it. And I think the wedding clothes, in a sense, is one of them. But earlier on, as far as the parable knows, nobody who was invited showed up. They were too busy. And they killed the people who were delivering the wedding invitations, or at least coming to remind them and ask them to come to the wedding. Maybe it makes some sense in the prior parable about the landowner and the vineyards. These are wedding invitations. They don't want to come. They don't have to come. Why would they kill the messenger? It just seems absurd. So when you decide that that this man who shows up with no royal garments for the wedding or no proper wedding attire, that he has to represent a believer just on the basis of his being there, then you have to apply that sort of literal rigidness throughout the parable, and it's not the right way to approach a parable. It is a teaching by analogy. And, in real life, God did not send written invitations to people. It's teaching by example. So what's really happening here? This guy shows up with not the right garment, and when he's asked about it, he has no answer. Why is it that he has not the right garment and the others do, given that the others don't seem to be pulled from those who got an invitation a long time before. It's people who were just pulled off the streets. As I said, the only thing that makes sense of that is that the proper attire was provided to them, and one would expect the king to do so. There's a difference between inviting people a long time ago who have time to prepare and just grabbing people, so to say, off the street. So I think that's the indication, merely that he doesn't have the attire provided by the king. He, like the Pharisees, has what Paul would call in Romans zeal, but not according to knowledge. He's come on his own basis, their own works. And there's little question, given the context, given that before and after the parable, the focus is on the Pharisees and the scribes as the audience, that the Pharisees, just before this parable, realize Jesus is addressing his parables to them specifically. In this story, the wedding, the guy that showed up in the wrong clothes, he's a Pharisee or scribe. He's one of those who's already rejected Christ, who's plotting on how to kill him. They're convinced they'll be in the kingdom. So he has one of them show up only to be forcibly removed. But this isn't someone with mediocre faith. It's someone with no faith at all. And it should not bother us that a faithless person could show up in the kingdom, because, again, it's not saying this can or ever will actually happen. In the real kingdom, no one that's unsaved will ever show up. Matthew 25 will make it clear. This is a parable. It's using an analogy of another king in another place, and it's symbolic of what will happen, or by analogy of what will happen in the final judgment. But it's not trying to describe precise events in that sense. And so we should not be bothered by the idea that someone who's not a believer could show up to the wedding in the context of this parable. So he's thrown out in the outer darkness, where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And as I've suggested in the first session, all the weeping and gnashing of teeth verses, whether they are the result of being thrown in the outer darkness or the furnace, they are the same result because they come from the same cause. These people have been permanently separated from God, dispatched ultimately to the lake of fire, or to hell, or to Hades. Now, the last verse, 14, many are invited, but few are chosen. That few are chosen, I think, obscures a little bit the Greek. Not particularly important, perhaps, for our purposes in outer darkness. Obviously, the many invited in the parable are the ones who were invited in the parable. Who was invited in the parable? Well, ultimately, they invited everybody, Jews and Gentiles. The Jews were invited first. The Gentiles were invited later. The Gentiles didn't have as much time to show up to the banquet because they're more or less just out on the streets and in the markets when the servants come and say, come on, come to the wedding banquet, it's time. But in the parable, to say many are invited really is to say everyone was. And that's key, because the Jews are the ones with the original invites, and then he says, go get everybody, good and bad. The emphasis on just indiscriminately everybody. Many means all. Paul will frequently use many to mean all. It's just an idiomatic way of saying it. But then he says few are chosen. It should just say, but few chosen is added in there. Chosen is an adjective. It does not indicate a verb has happened. It's the adjective eklektos. Eklektos can have the meaning that you have been selected or picked for something. It just almost never does. That is, if you, and I don't have time to do it here, but I just want to, at a high level, say this. If you do a word study of the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, you look at all the uses of eklektos, you will see repeatedly that the idea is not an emphasis on somebody being the object of a selection process for whatever purpose. You'll also see that it never has anything to do with eternal salvation. But rather, the word gets used to describe the quality inherent of the very best. That is, if you were to go pick, what would the best be? And so, you know, the whole idea of picking or selecting is really removed from the picture, and it's merely just used as an adjective to describe that something is in some way the best. And so, in the Old Testament, we'll find, for example, pure gold. Well, pure is the very best gold you could have, right? So pure gold is really elect gold. When you get it translated into Greek, you'll use the word elect. A mighty men or young men that might be in an army, the mighty or the young, that's elect. The tallest trees, the fattest cows, elect. It's just used over and over and just dozens of times. Even in the literature outside the Bible, it's used in the same way. Philo writes and he describes Solomon and he says Solomon is elect. He says, why do I say he's elect? He's elect because that which is most, Abraham's elect. And the reason is because that which is most excellent is found in him. It's this idea, and you'll find it in most Greek lexicons. It's usually a secondary definition, but it's the idea that someone is elect or something is elect because they are choice in the sense of sort of the have the best qualities in some way of that group. And so Abraham had tremendous qualities, so he's called elect, and so forth. In this parable, Jesus contrasts the fact that essentially everybody's invited, but not everybody attends the banquet. That's all he's saying. Everybody's invited. He says many, it's everybody. Everybody's invited, but only a few are elect in this sense of having the very best quality. They are choice in that sense. And what does that mean? Well, everybody who actually showed up to the banquet, except the one clown that got thrown out for not having the right garment, they're excellent. Why are they excellent? I think because the king gave them a royal garment. I don't think it had anything to do with them, and that's why the parable hastens to add that when the servants went and gathered these people, they gathered good and bad. It wasn't that these people were all the very best in and of themselves. It wasn't that they were all saintly or holy in and of themselves. And yet, when they come to the banquet, and now they're the guest of who? The guest at the wedding of the Son. They were willing to come where those originally invited were not. And that is the reason that they are described as being elect. That is the reason they are described as having this excellence or distinguishing characteristic. Not because of who they were before the banquet, but because of their presence at the banquet. They accepted. So that's the idea. Well, next time I'll move to Matthew 25 and cover the very challenging parable of the talents, where I will again suggest that the outer darkness is a reference to being excluded permanently from the kingdom and therefore having your destiny in the lake of fire. There's no room in this Gospel of Matthew for a group of people who are temporarily excluded. It does great injustice to Matthew 25, and I think it'll help getting through that last chapter to see all this come together. God bless you, and we'll see you next time.